Rural farmer John Duarte was caught plowing his field by the Army Corps of Engineers and fined $2,800,000. That fine leads us to ask, can farmers grow food under such diligent supervision by the government?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, thank you, Will Strickland, and hello out there. You are tuned into the 1111th edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or, hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Larnaca who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Jason Struby on the boards. Jason, got a question for you.
All right.
Now, do you think farmers should ask permission from the government to plow their property?
I don't see why. If it's their property, one would think they could do any plowing they wished.
Hmm. Well, what about you, Miss Producer Kelly Bear?
I also think that it would make sense that they could plow their own land. However, there can be unintended consequences that maybe that people don't think about, so perhaps some regulations would be good.
So perhaps they should get permission from the government to plow their own property.
Perhaps.
All right. Miss Sarabelle, what do you think?
Well, I'm feeling pretty conflicted about this right now. If you got to get permission to do something, that might prevent farmers from growing as much as they can right now, and that will significantly affect food for all American families. However, there may be, like Kelly said, environmental implications involved in this game, and that's what I'm really interested in finding out today.
And so we have some issues to shake out here. Well, folks, John Duarte purchased some farmland in Northern California with the intention of growing wheat. Since the farmland contains swales and wetlands, Duarte hired a consulting firm to tell him where he could and could not plow so as not to disturb the waters of the United States. Well, got the information, and he plowed, and he proceeded to plant his farmland with wheat. But before the wheat could be harvested, the Army Corps of Engineers issued a cease and desist order to Duarte for not obtaining a permit to move soil. Duarte then sued the Army Corps of Engineers for depriving him of his constitutional right of due process for issuing the cease and desist order without a public hearing. Nevertheless, Duarte is scheduled to stand trial in federal court this summer and face a $2.8 million fine for failing to get permission to plow his land. So we ask, can farmers grow our food? That's what they do. But can they do that under such diligent government supervision? Here to help us dig for an answer, we have Anthony Francois, who is senior attorney for the Pacific Legal Foundation. Anthony, welcome to the Food Chain.
Hi, good morning. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Pleasure to have you aboard. Pacific Legal Foundation, what is that?
Pacific Legal Foundation is a nonprofit public interest law firm, essentially. We represent property owners and others pro bono, meaning we don't have to charge them attorney fees, in disputes with the government over use of their property.
Mm-hmm.
We've won 9 cases at the Supreme Court of the United States, including multiple cases involving federal regulation of wetlands, most recently last spring in the Hawks case. And we represent John Duarte and his company, Duarte Nursery, again, pro bono, in their dispute with the federal government over plowing his property up near Red Bluff, which is south of Redding in Northern California.
Well, if you are representing people pro bono, who pays your way?
Well, we're supported by a wide range of donors and citizens who support our work with charitable donations, and it allows us to represent people without having to charge them. And what we find is that significantly levels the playing field in disputes that people have with the government, which basically tends to have limitless resources, especially the federal government.
Well, they think they have limitless resources, but they actually do. They're just like everybody else. And one can look at Venezuela for an example of a government that had unlimited resources and came up against its limits. So we wonder. This is a very interesting case, of course. But I'd like to start off with a general thought. When did government get the authority to prevent farmers from plowing their own land?
Well, that's an excellent question to start out with, and I think it flows pretty nicely from the discussion you had with your team there at the top of the show. The federal law that we're talking about is the Clean Water Act, and that actually does not require permitting for most farming activities. In fact, it specifically protects normal farming practices from the permitting requirements that the Army Corps of Engineers imposes for work in what are broadly defined as waters of the United States. And there is also a regulation implementing that law that says plowing to produce a crop is basically not regulated by the Clean Water Act. Mm-hmm. So I would say that the starting point is that Congress, I like to say in one of its rare lucid moments, recognize that the permitting regime that the Clean Water Act imposes is simply not practical for farming, and therefore provided this broad industry protection for farming.
It's kind of a farmer exemption?
It's codified in the Section 404 of the Clean Water Act, and it basically says that normal farming practices are not subject to the permitting requirements of the act, and nor are they subject to the prohibition. So that the act prohibits, as is relevant in this case, discharging dredged or filled material into waters in the United States. So the act does not apply to normal farming practices to the extent that they would result in, you know, deposits of dredged or filled materials into waters in the United States.
So, and then we turn our attention to the Farmer John Duarte case. And wonder, from what you just described, it sounds like Farmer Duarte was doing exactly what farmers do, plowing up his land and planting a crop and growing a crop. And then one day the Army Corps of Engineers shows up and gives him a cease and desist order. So where did that come from?
Well, that then is another excellent question. And the answer to that is that while the law provides this broad industry protection for farming from the permitting requirements, let me say a quick word about that protection in the law for farming.
Sure.
The permitting program that we're talking about on average requires more than 2 years of application time to just get the permit. And again, on average, more than $250,000 in consulting costs. Engineering firms and studies and things like this.
All of this to plant a crop?
Well, all of that to get a dredge and fill permit from the Corps of Engineers. And so that's the permitting regime that Congress looks at and says, well, we're not going to make farmers draw that permit in order to grow food. So this is why the Act protects farming from these permitting requirements. It's just not feasible to grow much food to eat if you have to do that. So instead of that pretty clear, simple law, the Corps of Engineers has developed a really counterintuitive way of reading and applying that. And under their view of it, that those protections don't apply in many circumstances where farmers would think they do. So in this case, they've said two things.
Well, wait a minute. Okay. You just talked about how Congress set aside farmers and said, you know, farmers don't count. And now the Army Corps of Engineers is saying, well, yes, they do.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Where did they get the authority to say, well, yes, they do, when Congress said they don't?
Yeah, we have argued throughout that they actually don't have the authority to change the law. This is an issue that applies more broadly to the work we do representing property owners against government interference. There is a long-standing practice, actually, within the federal government of allowing agencies to reinterpret the law to suit their, you know, passing political or policy agendas. So we think that in this particular case, it's an example of the Corps of Engineers staff thinking that there's something dangerous or illegitimate about that policy decision that Congress made to protect farming from the permitting requirements. And so they've tried to whittle away at it, to narrow it, to make it less available than the law provides.
Then before we pick up the case specifically, we're going to take a quick break. But folks, when we come back, we're going to look at and ask why the Army Corps of Engineers fined a farmer $2.8 million for plowing his field. What are we going to do? Can farmers grow our food under that kind of supervision? 831-479-1080. We will be right back with Anthony Francois, Pacific Legal Foundation, and you.
You can dream it, build it, own it, Metro Farm it. You can sow it, feed it, grow it, Metro Farm it. You can harvest it and dry it. You can sell it, Metro Farm it.
Learn how to dream it, build it, sow it, seed it, grow it, harvest it, sell it, Metro Farm it. Yes, you can do it. Dream it, build it, earn it, own it, Metro Farm it.
Oh, learn it, do it, earn it, Metro Farm it. Dream it, build it, own it. It's easy, you can do it, Metro Farm it.
It's all in Metro Farm, the guide to growing for the city. Get your copy today at metrofarm.com.
It's easy, you can do it, Metro Farm it. And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, one day, Farmer John Duarte planted wheat in his field, but the Army Corps of Engineers said you can't harvest that wheat. And as a matter of fact, we're going to fine you $2.8 million for moving your soil around without permission from us. So before we go on, Attorney Anthony Francois, who the heck is the Army Corps of Engineers?
Well, the Army Corps of Engineers is actually a part of the United States Army. And part of their mission does involve the actual Army stuff, to use a technical term.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they build bridges and roads and things
and
like
blow that. Things up.
Countries and in combat areas. And
yeah.
Oh, yeah, and they do some awesome work.
Kind of like the Seabees, right?
Yeah, the Army version of that. Yeah. But they also have a civilian function as a infrastructure and environmental agency within the United States. So going back to the beginning, the Army Corps of Engineers built and operated flood control projects. So they're involved in levee projects and flood control reservoirs all over the country, including in California, in the Sacramento Valley and other areas of the state. They then, in the have for a long time had some regulatory authority over navigable harbors under the Rivers and Harbors Act, and because of this role, they, when the Clean Water Act was passed in 1972, they were given a portion of the permitting authority under the Clean Water Act. Most of the Clean Water Act is enforced by the Environmental Protection Agency, and that's a whole other story. But the Army Corps of Engineers was given permitting authority for dredge and fill permits, basically projects, permitting authority over projects that would fill or excavate in navigable waters.
That does not count farmers, though, because Congress gave farmers the exemption.
So the history of that is actually kind of interesting, because the Clean Water Act applies to navigable waters, and in the early days of the Clean Water Act, the EPA and the Corps of Engineers developed regulations to define navigable waters, and they did so in the common sense way, as in navigation, floats, boats, rivers and lakes and streams and the ocean, and focus their authority, their permitting authority, on those, like, real water bodies. The courts subsequently overturned that in a suit by some environmental groups and said that actually the Clean Water Act applies much more broadly than just what you would naturally think of as water bodies. So in the wake of that, the Corps of Engineers developed a new definition of navigable waters. This was then in the mid-70s, and that new definition covered all kinds of ephemeral water bodies, small tributaries, small drainages, isolated wetlands of various types, ponds. These features all, to one degree or another, exist on a lot of farmland. And so when the Corps produced these draft regulations in the mid-70s, they warned, with this broader definition of navigable waters, now farmers are going to need dredge and fill permits. This produced a firestorm of controversy in the mid-70s. It led to this regulation by the EPA saying that plowing to produce a crop is not regulated by the Clean Water Act. And this is what led Congress to add provisions to the statute itself that protect farming, normal farming practices, from the both the prohibition on filling wetlands and the permitting requirements. And there's one basic proviso, which is that you cannot sort of use farming practices to completely obliterate existing wetlands. You got to farm with them. Okay. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, the effect of this early expansion of what the government considers to be a navigable water led to this controversy over whether or not it affected farming, and Congress answered that question by saying normal farming practices are not prohibited and they do not require permits.
Okay. And then something tells me we're going to continue this effort to regulate up the water channel, right, way up, until we end up with not even a water.
Correct. In fact, a lot of the areas that the Corps of Engineers and the EPA consider to be the federal government's water, you know, navigable waters, waters in the United States, are actually your dry land that is basically dry land 10 plus months out of the year, and then during the rainy season some water may flow through it or pond in it.
Okay, so now we're talking mud puddles.
That's definitely one category of thing that people have run afoul of the federal regulators under the Clean Water Act are, for example, work sites that are flat and don't actually have puddles or wetlands or streams in them, but over time, because you're moving equipment around or you're doing work, you actually develop some low spots that then start to fill with rainwater, and then suddenly the government shows up and says, aha, that's our water, you need our permission to work in it.
And now take us to Farmer John Duarte up in Red Bluff, California, which is a very dry place except for the Sacramento River that runs through it.
Correct. So Duarte Nursery is actually a Modesto-based wholesale nursery. They develop tree and vine. I want to say saplings, but that's not the right word. But anyway,
starts.
They sell baby trees and vines. Right. And they do business all over California and in some other states. And they're actually a fairly large operation there. In 2012, they took an opportunity to buy a piece of property up near Red Bluff. This is about, as the creek meanders, it's about 11 miles from the Sacramento River, and it's a few miles south of Red Bluff, west of the I-5 freeway. And you're right, it's this rolling red dirt, pretty dry, very dry in the summertime. Get some rainfall in the winter, but does not really sport, year-round water bodies other than the major creeks and the Sacramento River. So the property they own has a seasonal creek that runs along the north edge of it. And then it's dotted, maybe 5% of it has what are called vernal pools on it. And these are, if people aren't familiar, they're just low depressions in the ground that are underlain by, you know, the dirt under them is a hard clay layer that water doesn't soak through.
Talking mud puddles in, right?
Well, I mean,
big mud puddles.
But you know, it's fair to acknowledge that you know, these vernal pools support wetland type plants, and they definitely, you know, when the rainy season is in effect, you know, they hold water and they you know, they grow kind of wetland plants. And then during the summertime, they dry out, and then in the wintertime, the rain comes back and the plants come back. So they're very seasonal in that respect. But in terms of the amount of time that they're actually pools, 4 to 6, maybe 2 months out of the, 4 to 6 weeks, maybe 2 months out of the year. So you're talking about a seasonal feature. So, and then some of these are connected by swales and things like that, so there's a little bit of water that moves between them. But these are the features that we're talking about on the Duarte property.
Before he plowed his property, as I understand it, he hired a consulting firm, and he says, look at my property, tell me where I can plow and where I can't plow so I do not mess with the waters of the United States. At least that's what I heard happen. But when we come back from this break, we'll learn from Anthony Francois what really happened and how farmer John Duarte found himself the target of an attack by the U.S. Army on his farm. Right back.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, farmer John Duarte decided to plant some wheat in his new field up by Red Bluff, California. And so he did. Plowed up the ground, planted the wheat, and before he could harvest, though, the Army Corps of Engineers attacked. I wonder if they brought tanks in or something. Well, what did they attack for? What did the Army Corps of Engineers see John Duarte doing wrong to the extent that they fined him $2.8 million? Anthony?
Well, that's another good question to launch the next segment here. So, and no tanks, just cameras. But
okay. You know, interestingly enough, when I sent out a press release for this show, I called it U.S. Army Attacks U.S. Farmer. But essentially, that's what happened, is it not?
In court, yes. Yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, this is one of the examples. You know, we deal with a lot of, Pacific Legal Foundation, a lot of different federal regulatory agencies. And I think one of the underlying truths is that, you know, a program, you know, does its job, but then nobody folds it up and gives the people something different to do that's more relevant to the time.
So we had the Clean Water Act. We cleaned up the water. We have the cleanest water in the world, and we're making it cleaner and cleaner and cleaner and cleaner because that's what the bureaucracy does. They just keep going, right?
Well, there are things like mission creep and you know, drift from the purpose of a program into things which I think this case is a good example of, where first they make up a rule that we argue doesn't exist, and then they go around, you know, whacking people, enforcing a rule just because it's a rule. They can't really point to, you know, any serious adverse results of what was done. So here's what actually happened. You mentioned a consultant, and it's important to make sure we're clear about what happened with that. The consultant that gets discussed in some of the coverage of the story, it was a consultant that did a report for the fellow that Duarte Nursery bought the property from. And the purpose of that report was to try to identify where on the property there were what the Army Corps would currently consider to be navigable waters. And that was not to figure out where it could be plowed or not. That was to determine what portion of the property would be suitable for much more substantial earthwork that would be involved in planting a permanent orchard, like a walnut orchard.
Oh.
That involves much more substantial work that can actually, you know, I mentioned before these clay layers that, that basically form these vernal pools, otherwise the water just soaks into the ground. That deep ripping land in order to plant orchard crops, for example, can penetrate and break open those clay layers. That's actually the purpose of it, so that those roots get down deep to the water table, and can have the effect of permanently eliminating those vernal pools. And so that's a very different thing than simply plowing to plant wheat or hay or something like that.
Okay.
So the purpose of this report was to assess the value of the property for a permanent orchard planting, and not to determine whether and where it could be plowed just to plant an ordinary annual crop. So with this report in hand, though, the company bought the property. They flipped part of it, kind of about three-quarters of it, to another purchaser, and retained about 450 acres of it. And the portion that they retained, they didn't have a long-term plan for yet. Basically, the buyer hadn't wanted that piece. And so an associate of theirs, who sort of introduced them to this property in the first place, proposed planting a wheat crop on it, just, you know, get some revenue to pay the property tax and stuff like that. And so John, as the president of the company, he signed off on that with a couple of provisos. One, he said, you know, just make sure it's planted shallowly, you know, plowed shallowly, and do your best to stay out of, you know, the vernal pools. You know, we don't really need a permit for that, but, you know, abundance of caution.
Sure.
You know, let's not do everything we're allowed to do. So their associate went and hired a contractor to plant the wheat crop, got the part about doing the plowing shallowly, but did not execute the mark off the vernal pools and make sure the contractor stays out of them. That only got about half done. And so about half of the vernal pools, which add up to about 20 acres on this 450-acre plot, did get plowed once through to a depth of about 6 inches. And that's basically all that happened. And then they hired an aircraft to fly on the wheat seed, and they were off to the races with that. As it turns out, an employee of the Corps of Engineers happened to be driving by one of the days that the contractor was plowing it. He jumped to the immediate conclusion that what they were doing was not plowing it, but this deep ripping that I described earlier, which would have required a permit for portions of this property. And so he did a very cursory investigation. He did not really elicit the information that would have been useful to him from Duarte Nursery, from John Duarte, from the fellow that was kind of the go-between, or the contractor. He basically gathered information by taking some photographs on the site. He wrote up a report saying, okay, these guys have permanently destroyed 20-plus acres of wetlands, plowed this property 3 feet deep, and he claimed they knew they needed a permit for this, and they did it anyway. This is a flagrant violation of the Clean Water Act, and so he recommended enforcement action against it. So the problem with this is it's basically kind of a parallel universe, or what's the expression these days? Alternative facts. What actually happened on the property was it was plowed about 6 inches deep. None of these vernal pools were significantly impacted by it, and the company's knowledge of the situation did not require them to get a permit. Okay, so on the other hand, the investigator, who never really gets the information needed from the party he's investigating, makes these wild accusations that it was plowed 3 feet deep, deep ripped, permanently destroy the wetlands, you know, done this on purpose to avoid him.
And, of course, since it's John Duarte and Duarte Family Nurseries, a lot of money, we can make a great example out of this one, right?
Well, possibly, although I think that I think really the reason there's this kind of overzealous enforcement up in that area of California right now is that there are a lot of farmers taking opportunities to do orchard plantings up there.
Oh.
So that does require some that can, depending on the circumstances, require some permitting with the Corps of Engineers. Basically, it's a response to the uncertainty of water availability in the southern parts of the Central Valley. So the groundwater situation is a lot better up around Red Bluff, and even though it's not optimum soils, a lot of farmers are tired of dealing with the federal government's water program.
Well, there you go. So they can get the water out of the ground then.
Yep. So okay. They're adapting to that. The Corps and other agencies, I think, are simply biased against permanent crops like this.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. Right back. Stay tuned.
History buffs. This tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place off Guadalcanal, September 1942.
I heard Mr. Schaefer say there's a splash up forward. Then the fireworks began. The Wasp was forward of us when three torpedoes hit her amidships starboard side. She started blazing and the smoke was pouring out of her up forward. The destroyer O'Brien intercepted a torpedo meant for the Wasp. We tried to take a torpedo as well, but it went right under our bow and hit the North Carolina. I ran after a life jacket and a tin hat. When I returned, the Wasp was down by the bow in a mass of flames. While the whole fleet was swinging around, we dropped two 600-pound depth charges on a contact. All this happened in about 15 minutes, and there was no unnecessary excitement on board at all. Everyone remained calm.
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Yeah, quick point of clarification from our producers here. Was it the intention of John Duarte to start an orchard on that 450-acre parcel?
No. No, as a matter of fact, the government has claimed that plowing the property was part of, I call it a conspiracy to commit walnuts, that even though plowing doesn't require a permit, ultimately, if they had planted an orchard, they may have needed a permit, and so they've tried to, describe this as some sort of
a sneak attack to build a
gradually preparing it for orchards. But no, the company had the possibility in mind that it might be able to develop an orchard on this property, but the precise reason why they were willing to let their friend do the wheat crop that year was because they really didn't know what they wanted to do with it ultimately, and so that gave the property something to do in the meantime.
Okay, so let's turn now to the waters of the United States, and I asked producer Sarah Bell here to get a handle on this for us really quickly, and she came up with the notion that it depends on what political party you are with as to what exactly the waters of the United States are. Is that true, Sarah?
Yes, I've found through some little bit of homework that there are currently two different widely accepted interpretations of waters of the United States, or WOTUS. There's Justice Anthony Kennedy's definition, which is, and I quote, navigable waters that include any water body that has a significant nexus or a significant connection or tie to navigable rivers and seas, including through biological or chemical connections. And then there's Antonin Scalia's definition, which is waters that contain, and I quote, a relatively permanent flow or that possess a, quote, a continuous surface connection to waters with a relatively permanent flow.
Okay, so that sound about right, Anthony?
That's spot on. Both of those views of the meaning of navigable waters come from a Supreme Court decision in 2006. That PLF actually won, the Rapanos case. And, both of those decisions come from a conclusion that, sort of similarly conclude that the Corps of Engineers definition of navigable waters is too broad.
Mm-hmm.
and invalid. So most courts have applied Justice Kennedy's much broader view of what can be considered navigable waters. There's a controversy right now over whether or not Justice Scalia's view of it, which was joined by three other judges on the court, is the correct one.
Okay, so this is a political definition that we're working on then, right? I mean, this...
Well, it is partly that, but partly it's also legal. So you've got two Supreme Court justices that have two alternate views of what the term means. The agency then has decided it will use both. In the wake of President Trump's election, he sent out an executive order directing the agencies to consider using only Justice Scalia's version of the term.
But that's... So so the previous administration was... I guess of Barack Obama was going for the Kennedy's definition, and even further refining it, as I understand it, to include mud puddles.
Yes, so it is, I think, important to note that the Bush administration prior to the Obama administration also embraced the much broader Kennedy view of the act, and the way of defining navigable waters that the government is using against Duarte Nursery right now comes from that Bush era 2008 guidance, defining how to explaining how to identify waters of the U.S. What we think is probably more indicative of the Obama administration is the application of that to this very marginal case. So it's really kind of the very aggressive enforcement of that, along with the whittling down of the farming protections that would only have happened under the prior administration.
Okay. Now, one would think that the Army Corps of Engineers would be rather mathematical about its decision-making, but something tells me that politics have an impact on their decision-making like it does on everybody's decision-making. Am I wrong?
Well, that's hard to really assess in this case. I mean, we've had the opportunity to depose all the people involved in the Army Corps' decision to pursue this as an enforcement action. And really what it boils down to, I don't know if it's political, but I would say that it is ideological. As I mentioned before, the actual Clean Water Act, the law that Congress passed, provides this broad, comprehensive protection for farming, and the Corps of Engineers staff read it much more narrowly. And so, for example, if you've got an interruption in your farming practice, let's say there's a bankruptcy, or a sale of the farm, or there's a family succession, or you're just following market conditions and changing crops, they consider changed farming practices not to be normal because they're not, in their view, normal for what you've always done.
Okay.
So, and this is, I think very few farmers who are, a lot of farmers are familiar with the fact that the Clean Water Act.
Gonna hold that when we take a quick break. But when we come back, I have to ask you the big question. Can farmers grow our food? Right back.
Here's a little secret I'm telling you. Take a little pledge called the 2x2. Spend $2 on local food each day and get two friends to do the same and play. Oh, they'll spend their money, and when they're through, they'll get two friends and do it too.
We can eat our way to economic security and personal freedom. It won't cost an extra dime, and it will be so easy, it will make you blush. All it takes is two numbers. One is two, the other is 2-2. Join us. Take the 2x2 pledge.
There's a little secret I shared with you, a simple pledge called the 2x2. You can do it. It don't cost much. It's so easy, it'll make you blush. Pledge two local bucks each day. Get two others to pledge and play.
Take your 2x2 pledge at metrofarm.com.
2x2.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, it's been 5 years since Farmer John Duarte's crews took a plow through a vernal pool, which those of us from Montana called mud puddles. So after 5 years, it should be plenty evident that what kind of damage was done to the pool.
Well, that's correct. And, you know, John has had to hire experts to meet the, you know, to contend with the government's stable of hired experts who've all flown in from all over the country to pick over his property. And the, you know, consensus view of our experts is that there's really no harm done. Even if this were a violation, this is not something that harmed these vernal pools. On the margin, it made a few of them a little bit bigger. And, you know, the current condition of the wetland plants is robust. You know, as with everything in the region, during the drought, these and all the other vernal pools were struggling a little bit. Once we return to normal rainfall conditions, they're doing fine. So, you know, this is the sort of thing that even if it were a violation, and, you know, we continue to disagree with that, it's a no harm foul.
So $2.8 million. You know what? I wonder. We have the government to protect our water, to keep it clean, and the government has done a great job of doing just that. But who's going to protect, you know, business from the government? It seems to me like we have done such a good job, especially here in California, of chasing away our industry because it's dirty. And then we run down to the big box store and buy made in China because it's cheap, which is really convenient for us. But in the end, you know, we're going to look a lot less, in my estimation, like America the Beautiful and more like Venezuela the Bankrupt. So how do we square that?
Well, part of the answer, I'm happy to report to your question, you know, who's going to protect business and individuals from the government. Yeah, that's Pacific Legal Foundation's mission, is to protect individual and constitutional rights from government infringement. And you can learn a lot more about what we do at our website at pacificlegal.org. I think in general, it's necessary for people to become more educated about the ways that government can simply kind of get, I mean, we talked earlier about mission creep and, you know, just how you get further and further into the weeds and suddenly you are enforcing laws against people that there's no reason to do. That it's beyond the scope of the law, that it's, you know,
unless you don't like them, unless they're of the wrong political persuasion, unless they haven't contributed enough money. There's lots of reasons.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the dangers of, you know, allowing government to do its work, you know, without transparency and without accountability. I mean, one of the claims that, you know, we've made on the company's behalf against the government is a due process violation. You know, they made this early determination that he had violated the law after getting the facts all wrong, never provided him a hearing before shutting down his farm. Due process really is a thing that's fundamental to our view of how the government should work, which is they cannot make secret decisions about you.
And that appears to be the situation here, a secret decision. I don't know. Thanks so much, Anthony, for joining us. Thank you all for tuning in. This has been the Food Chain Radio Program. Watch for the Duarte case in August.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends miss the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.